honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, you'll find a short video of Bill Helton describing the day he was wounded in Korea at the tender age of 18. You can see what a baby-faced Marine he was when he enlisted at 17, and also see what he looks like now. At different times in his 30 years in the Marine Corps, he was ordered to both shave his signature mustache and grow it back. We heard how he met his wife of nearly 64 years, Barbara, and we know you were wounded in Korea and Vietnam, but in between, you know, there was a little thing called the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we don't talk about that all that much. And sometimes I'm struck by the reality that as significant as the things that happened are, sometimes the things that didn't happen or almost happened are just as significant. And while Kennedy and Khrushchev are doing all their posturing, you're actually on the ground in Cuba creating infantry defenses for land warfare, right?
For the Cuban Missile Crisis, I figure that all my years in the Marine Corps, that was my most important operation. It was far more important to the United States than Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, or any of these other countries. In fact, the Cuban Missile Crisis was a lot more important than a lot of the islands in the Pacific that we should have bypassed. The Marine Corps had an operation going on in Villegas, Puerto Rico. So they didn't... I went in and I told Barbara, I said, Barbara, I'll be a little late. It was a Sunday. And I told Barbara, I said, I'll be a little late coming home. I says, keep the roast on. Anyway, I went in and they loaded four trucks, give us our weapons, took us to Cherry Point, put us on airplanes. We went up in the air, and we thought we were going to Villegas. And we land on an airstrip someplace in the Caribbean. And turned out, the pilot says, you're in Gitmo, Cuba. My friend says, well, don't worry. We've got live ammunition, but we don't have grenades. Then a messenger came around and says, all platoon sergeants, go over and draw your grenades. So I went over to get grenades, and it says, oh, you can't have these. These belong to the 1st Marine Division, and we were 2nd Division. Two divisions of the Marine Corps hadn't been together since World War II. But anyway, something's wrong. My lieutenant, I had a rifle platoon of 44 men, but my lieutenant was, he was going to legal school in Rhode Island. So I had the platoon without an officer. Some of the troops were on leave, and I think I had out of 40 men, I think I had about 27 or 28, and it was the largest platoon. And anyway, he'd get mowing, says, okay, we're moving out. And about dusk, we set up in a chief housing area. We didn't set up, we just lay down and slept on the ground. And there happened to be a mailbox in the area. They gave us a box of sea rations, had cardboard in it, and I took out the cardboard out and wrote a note on it, addressed it to Barbara, my wife, put a stamp on it that was in my wallet, and dropped it in the mailbox, telling her that, hey, we're in Gitmo, and we're not in Villegas. She got the letter, and they took us through the area, and the next day we went to the rifle range in Cuba. They said, you're going to dig in on the rifle range. The rifle range was at a low ground, and I think it was a mountain, Loma Picote was on the other side. The rifle range and then a fence line over to Cuba. The Cuban National Guard was supposed to be manned in the fence line, and that's what I was worried about, because, you know, with seasoned troops, no problem. But when you got National Guard or civilians, you don't know what's going to happen. But anyway, we dug in facing the fence, and between us was a minefield of 55,000 unmarked mines. But we're dug in, and then told us that we're going to have to make a permanent position. So they came up and told me, okay, Sergeant, mark where you want your platoon holes, and we're going to have Seabees come up and build these bunkers. And they built huge bunkers with thick steel cement over them. And he says, we want bunkers for a whole platoon, not just your 27 or 28 men. So anyway, and the troops smoked at night. They couldn't smoke because they didn't want the Cubans to see where we were. But while they were building, the CBs were building a hole, they had their spotlights. They were working around it. And it was okay. They could spot us with the spotlight. And anyway, we sat there for at least 30 days or longer. We were in Cuba for the missile crisis. Here, about a few years ago, on public television, they had a special on the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I didn't realize how bad off we were. The United States had sacrificed, or they'd marked off the troops in Gitmo. Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is on the southern tip of Cuba. The United States had all their seasoned troops, the ones that had more training than us, on the aboard ship, and were going to invade the north end of Cuba. They figured the Cubans would use it. They did not have regular weapons. They had atomic-type weapons. And so we would have been marked off had it not ended like it did.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying you guys, they're defending the American base at Guantanamo. You were expendable. You would have been the sacrificial lambs in this operation.
We were. And anyway, from what I understand, is the president had made an agreement with the Joint Chiefs of Staff that if any planes or anybody gets killed in Cuba, they can bomb. The Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted to bomb. They were kind of upset about having to pull out of Korea like they did, and they wanted to bomb. And anyway, the president asked them, can you get all the missiles they'd spotted? And they said, well, we can get 90% of them. They figured 10% of the Cuban missiles, Castro wanted to fire on the United States. But with 10% of the missiles, atomic weapons would have wiped out the East Coast, probably a third of the population of the United States. People don't realize that. That's a lot more important to the United States than us defending Korea or Vietnam. We would have lost a third of the population had they not settled it. And with the settlement, Kennedy made a deal with Khrushchev that he would pull the missiles out of Turkey and Greece if Khrushchev would take them out of Guantanamo, but don't let the American public know about it. They did not want this. And in fact, they pulled a lot of the stuff out of our record books because they did not want. We'd been put in for a unit citation, and no, we want to forget about Cuba Missile Crisis.
Well, and I'm glad you shared that perspective, that in your mind that was more significant than some of the other things you're engaged in. But I'm wondering on a micro level for you, because you spent many nights on the front lines in Korea and in Vietnam. But those days and nights there in Cuba, on the edge of a minefield with enemy troops across the way that you don't know who they are or what their capabilities are, can you help us understand what kind of tension or anxiety or anticipation you felt?
The military suspected that there was enemy line crossers coming across and spying on the base. To me, I thought that was nonsense because the gate was open and workers came over and worked during the day and went back at night. But anyway, they decided they were going to bring a dog up and go out and catch line crossers. A Navy personnel, a seaman, came up with a big Belgian Shepherd. And they says, well, Sergeant, go out. I want you to go out and spend the night with the dog and the sailor. So we went out and laid in the grass on the rifle range. It's raining, the dog's smelling, the dog's getting wet. The sailor says, now, this dog, this is not his training. He's a warehouse dog, and when I let him tell him to go, he's going to attack anybody except me. So you stay on my right side. And I said, that's no problem, because I've got a 45 with a round in the chamber, and you make sure he stays on your left side. I laid there all night in the rain with the dog. And we came back, and this is, okay, you didn't do too good. You didn't catch anybody. We're going to have two dogs tomorrow night. And I said, I need the day off. I need a day of R&R. So I took off, and I went back to the got a ride back to the base and went to the staff NCO club, and I stayed there till it closed at night, and then went out and slept under the bushes until next morning when I get back to my unit. But I didn't want to spend another night in the rain with a dog for a minefield with 55,000 mines in it. We had one casualty, young trooper that some way wandered into the minefield, and a staff sergeant had to go out from another company and bring him back, and they hit a mine, and they got shrapnel. It wasn't considered a war. They did not get a Purple Heart. They got no recognition for it, and it was covered up.
Yeah, one of those chapters of history we don't hear all that much about. While the Vietnam War, a lot has been said about, a lot was written about, and you spent a lot of time over there. How many separate tours did you have in Vietnam?
I had three tours in Vietnam. The first one was a short tour. I was seagoing on a cruiser firing on the coast. And the second two, I was back to infantry with rifle companies.
And I know there's so many different things that happened there, but you did get another Purple Heart over there. What happened in that situation?
In that situation, we had moved up we were in I Corps. It wasn't that great a deal. We were set up on our base, and the first night there, we got 500 rockets on the base, and I think we had 16 killed. But from our base was close enough to North Vietnam where we got rocketed and mortared constantly. Well, about the third or fourth night there, I got hit. I was out manning a position and got hit by shrapnel from I think it was a 120 or 40 millimeter rocket. But it was just shrapnel in the back and shoulder.
Well, and there's another kind of close call I want to make sure I ask you about. There was a helicopter. You started to get aboard, and something changed your mind. And while it was tragic for the guys on that helicopter, that your decision saved your life.
They told me, we're turning the base over to the Arvins, these South Vietnamese. They're going to take the base. And so the helicopters came in and to fly us out. And meantime, I had what we call a water buffalo, a 500-gallon trailer, water trailer, that I had up on the fire support base for our water. It was about the last helicopter. They said, okay, get aboard. And I started to go aboard it, and then I backed out. And I said, nope, I'm not going without my water. I'm not giving up my water. I'm not going to let the Arvins have my water trailer. I want my water buffalo. So I got off, and the helicopter went up and got up probably about 10, 12 feet in the air, blew up, and went down. And it had a number of Marines that were killed on there. They think it was probably a rocket. If it wasn't a rocket, it could have been Marines carried their hand grenades in their lapels, in their buttonholes, and they would bend the pins so they would come out easier. And they figured it might have been a hand grenade come out on the helicopter or a rocket. But anyway, I didn't get on it, and I watched it burn, and it was pretty sad. The water buffalo probably saved my life, or anyway, for going down with a helicopter.
Well, and I'm just thinking about everything that we've talked about here. Wounded multiple times in Korea. One of them, you got the Purple Heart. Wounded in Vietnam. Mortar round that's a dud that might have killed you. B-52s bombing all around you. The helicopter you're about to go on blows up. You've dodged a lot of bullets, literally and figuratively. How do you explain all that? How do you explain the fact that you made it through all that and
here you are, 90, almost 91, still going strong.
And never had any thoughts about it. It's just something, it's like I've always said, the wicked never die young, and I didn't have to worry. It was just my good friends I lost.
When somebody says Semper Fi, or they say once a Marine, always a Marine, what do those things mean to you?
That's my life. That's the only thing I've ever been is a Marine. When they play the Marine Corps helm, it just sends deals through my body. I do not regret anything I've ever done. I wish I could have got in a little earlier.
Well, and I don't want to forget anything. If there's something that's important to you, please feel free to share. But I'm not going to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story that nobody else could. Is there something that you would say as you look back over almost 91 years now, you'd say you're most proud of or you're most thankful for?
Just being able to serve the country. That's it. And when people come up and thank me for service, you know, I tell them, I want to thank you because you helped provide the country. You paid your taxes. I'm indebted to you for being able to do what I wanted to that I couldn't have done without your support.
Bill Helton, he'll turn 91 next month when he and Barbara will also celebrate anniversary number 64. Bill had a few more Marine Corps memories that wouldn't quite fit into our radio time today, but they are included in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.